They tell me I'm the last bona fide water route postman in the United States. One fellow in the Northeast runs water mail in the summer, but his route freezes come winter. I'm the only year-rounder left. The route takes me a hair less than 2 hours, when the wind's calm. By land, the route would take me 8. Newspaper reporters from Birmingham and Atlanta have written stories about me. A man from a fishing magazine wrote about me, and television reporters have come from Atlanta and Savannah. They ride in my boat, take my picture, write what I say. A columnist from the Mobile paper rides with me every chance he can. His bosses think he's working. But I don't run this route to set records or to see my picture in the newspaper. My reasons are complicated, at least to me. If I'm ever to feel like a man, I think it will happen here. If I'm ever to make it all up to Rebecca, this is where that will happen.
I'm Jay Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today we have a special treat, an original Christmas story, The River Whispers Her Name, penned and performed by Jay Greenland.
Somewhere in all this water, I think, someday before I die, I'll find the courage to grow to manhood, something that has escaped me since that Christmas 54 years ago, when all I could do was run home to Mama and cry. Maybe my fear is as simple as this. Maybe, after losing my courage that night, I'm afraid it skipped out for good. Maybe when I'm done telling this, you'll understand. Maybe I will.
Jay Greenland, writer, publicist, governor's speechwriter, crafter of Christmas stories, and curator of traditions. Welcome. So, Jay, tell us about the origins of this Christmas story. I know that you write fiction and nonfiction, but you were primarily known for the Sweet Tea column that you did for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. This has its hand in truth, and also you kind of fictionalized it.
This idea came to me when I was writing a column for the Mobile Register in South Alabama, and there really was a guy who ran his mail route on the river, and I rode with him a couple of times and always wanted to ride with him at Christmas, never got the chance, so I decided just to turn it into a story. So I fictionalized it using some real characters from down there, and we ran it out as a 3-part series in the newspaper for Christmas that year.
And just to kind of set the stage for us, give us a sense of what it's like to deliver mail in a place that's primarily wet.
Well, obviously, it's very rural. It's beautiful. There's, as the name would imply, magnolia trees everywhere. It's an amazing place. There's oak trees, pine trees, fish jumping. You start at the post office that morning, load up the boat and head out.
With huge bags of mail. And so are the mailboxes on posts near the docks?
They're actually on the docks and they twirl. And Huey Collins, who is the guy that I knew down there, was so good. He knew exactly when to throttle back on his motor. He would glide in, he could flip the box open, throw the mail in, flip it back and push it around so it turned back and faced the dock again, which is how people knew he'd been there without ever stopping.
And this story, it's a bit of a ghost story. It's a Christmas story. It has a little Charles Dickens in it,
yeah,
in the sense that there's ghosts and sadness and kind of hope. Could you just set up the story for us?
What gave me the idea for the story was one night when my own daughter walked out of the house without us knowing it, kind of startled us. And so I just combined that event and how that affected me into this story about the mail route, moved it down farther south in Alabama. And so it's just a story of a male guy and a family and an encounter and an experience one Christmas that marked them all. My birth certificate name is Floyd Earl, but when my kinfolk said Floyd Earl without a break, one of my cousins thought they were saying Fordor, and that's the name that stuck. I'm the last bona fide river route mailman in the entire United States. A couple of carriers elsewhere in the country run a river route in the summer until their river freezes. But no one anywhere else delivers an entire route 6 days a week, not counting Christmas, 52 weeks a year. At least that's what the newspaper reporters write. When you deliver mail in a boat on the Magnolia River in the South, reporters like to write stories about you, and they expect you to be a character. So I oblige them by saying things like Bombingham for Birmingham, and I always keep my bottomless glass jug of syrupy sweet tea at my feet although the T is not an act.
And in this story, it's interesting because you kind of, you insert yourself
right.
a little bit.
John Steinbeck did it in East of Eden. So I figure, he even used his own last name, so I figure I could do it in this. Most reporters show up, spend a day with me, write a story, and that's the last I hear from them. So I can tell the same stories over and over, and they are none the wiser. But the guy from Mobile is down here so much, I have to keep the stories fresh. But there was one story I never told him, a personal one.
I'm Jay Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking to Arkansas writer and columnist Jay Greeland, who's spinning a Christmas story, The River Whispers Ernie.
When Fordor Freeman was a kid on the river, Art Radley was the man who put her down the river with their Christmas packages. Art had moved down from Monroeville up in central Alabama. If that town sounds familiar, it's the hometown of that woman who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. Art Radley just showed up in Magnolia Springs in 1939, shortly after Halloween. He was a young man and nobody knew him. There were stories that he had been in some trouble up there, and his family sent him down. On what turned out to be Art's last Christmas on the mail boat, he delivered the first load of presents on the Monday before Christmas. I was 12 years old that day, and I remember it like it was the day before yesterday. My mother, Estelle, my kid sister, Rebecca, and I met Art at the pier. Mama was expecting a package. As Art throttled down, he hollered his standard greeting to us.
Fordor Freeman, he's our man. If he can't do it, Rebecca can.
So that's a great name, Fordor Freeman. You talked a little bit about it, but everybody has a nickname, right?
Yes, and this one's based on someone who's close to me, but I can't say who. He doesn't know I've appropriated for this story, but it's too good not to use.
Yeah, it is a great name, absolutely.
So there we were, 12-year-old Fordor and Rebecca, who was barefoot. The mosquitoes were chewing her legs into hamburger.
Anything from Monkey Ward's?
Not today.
Tuesday morning.
Anything from Monkey Ward's?
Not today.
Wednesday.
Not today, Estelle.
Art, it's Christmas Eve. Tomorrow's the last day for mail. It's for Rebecca.
If it don't come tomorrow, Estelle, I've got something you can give her. I'll bring it down no later than midnight, Christmas Eve.
Late that night, on the eve of Christmas Eve, Rebecca, who had heard her mother whisper that the gift was for her, slipped out of bed and pattered over the rough-cut cedar planks of the dog trot that connected the two wings of the Freeman house. Mrs. Freeman was in the kitchen, tamping down the cook stove fire for the night. Mr. Freeman was in the kitchen, too, his back to the door. Mrs. Freeman reached to turn off the Motorola tombstone, but the radio announcer's voice abruptly cut into the final notes of Greensleeves, and she stopped.
As you know, if you tuned in earlier, Greg Golden, Roman, and Lori's boy escaped from Altamont 2 days ago. Sheriff Collins expects Greg will show up to see his folks. The sheriff asked me to remind our listeners, and the Goldens may forgive me, but Greg has been known to hurt folks for unknown reasons. If you see him, treat him like a rabid dog.
Neither parent noticed Rebecca glide ghost-like outside on the dog trot, although Rebecca wasn't sneaking. She just didn't think to tell them she was leaving. In fact, her mission was to walk to the post office and find that present.
That was the obvious and logical solution.
Never mind that it was 9:15 at night, and Rebecca had no idea which direction to walk. So she set out on the silty white sand lane and walked north toward Baldwin County Road 311. By the time Mr. Freeman discovered Rebecca wasn't in her bed, she'd been gone an hour. By the time Mr. Freeman tromped through the trees with Four-Door on his heels and walked the length of the pier to peer into the river, Rebecca had been gone nearly 2 hours. Mrs. Freeman and Four-Door were sitting on the pier.
Sheriff Collins is on the way.
I'm frightened.
Don't be.
What if Greg Golden sneaked in and snatched her? You heard he was on the loose.
Four-Door snuggled in tight against his mother and stared in the water and felt guilty. Guilty because he had seen his sister scooting down the dog trot stairs into the yard and walking off into the dark. He had watched his sister disappear onto the trail and into the trees, but he thought that she would turn around and come back. When she didn't, he was too afraid of the dark to go after her. Now he was too ashamed to admit this, and he was terrified that Rebecca was going to be lost forever.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to A Christmas Story, The River Whispers Her Name, written and performed by Jay Greeland.
Wind whooshed in from the west through the tree branches and slapped the water against the riverbank.
It's 1 minute past midnight and officially Christmas Eve.
Suddenly, Four-Door heard a voice, which he first thought was the wind.
Rebecca.
He heard it again, the unmistakable whisper of a woman. Then he realized that the whisper had swirled up from the troubled water beneath his feet. Sheriff Collins was 40 minutes getting to the Freemans, so by the time he was standing in their kitchen, Rebecca had been gone nearly 3 hours. Together, they searched the trail to the home of Mrs. Freeman's sister, Robin, and her husband, Terry, a quarter mile north. They swung lamps over the bank to look into the water. They were still standing on the pier as the sun rose over the east bank of the Magnolia. And at that moment, the moment the first orange light glanced off the river into their faces, Art Radley appeared in his boat. He killed the engine and his boat glided the final distance to the pier.
I heard. I'm sorry. I stayed close to the shore all the way here.
Art looked at Mrs. Freeman.
Nothing from Monkey Ward, Estelle.
Art yanked the rope and revved his 5-horse Evinrude.
We'll find her, Estelle.
But they didn't.
Let's return as Jay Greeland continues his Christmas story, The River Whispers Her Name, this time from Rebecca's point of view.
I went to work.
no trace of Rebecca. The last of the searchers left for home, grateful they could return to their homes where all their children were present and accounted for. Except, of course, for the Goldens, whose son on the run still hadn't appeared. For Rebecca, the mission was perfectly sensible. Her gift had to be somewhere at the post office. If Art Radley couldn't find it, she would. So Rebecca turned out of her bed, slipped on the moccasins Aunt Robin had given her, and quietly descended the stairs into the yard.
After a while, I got stagnant. Things just weren't the same. So I got down on my knees.
Rebecca had no idea where the post office was, but neither doubt nor fear were in her constitution. So she walked north along the white silt lane, past Robin and Terry's house, and into the full dark of Christmas Eve. After an hour, Rebecca began to feel sleepy, just as she was passing Samantha Grace Kaufman's 80-year-old brick silo, which stood between the river and the road. She shuffled through the sand and crawled inside through an opening that was about half as tall as a door. She sat down and settled against the wall, falling asleep. A rustling inside the silo awakened Rebecca, who turned to her right to see the shadow of a man crawling into the silo.
What are you doing here?
Going to the post office. Are you going to the post office?
Although the sky was turning pink with dawn, there was no light inside the silo. The man dug into his right pants pocket and fished out the 55-cent tin Zippo that the prison guard had given him as he held the door open for the man's escape. The man thumbed the steel, rolled it against the flint. The flame lit the wick, and he held the cigarette lighter above his head.
Where do you live?
With my mama and daddy.
I'll take you home.
I have to go to the post office.
Okay, then. But we can't go anywhere until nighttime. What's your last name?
Rebecca Gail Freeman.
What's your daddy's name?
Mr. Freeman. What's your name?
Santa Claus.
They spent the day in the silo, Rebecca becalmed by the man's promise to take her to the post office. At 8 p.m., the man held out his right hand and said,
"Come on."
And now I'm fishing.
They crawled out of the silo, but instead of taking the lane, the man cut toward the river. At the bank of the Magnolia, they turned north on the foot-worn trail that paralleled the river. 100 yards to the north, they could see a light, which was a lantern hanging from a hook on Art Radley's dock. Art had tied up his boat and was covering the Evan route for the night when the man and Rebecca walked onto his pier.
So we have little Rebecca, she's left the house, she's looking for the present, and she finds herself crawling into like a silo kind of building.
It's an old grain silo.
And she's waiting. Why does she crawl in there?
Because she was sleepy, she was tired, and the silo was familiar to her. She had played in it, and so it just seemed like a good place to go take a nap.
And like all scary stories, even though this is a Christmas story, some man or apparition or thing appears in that silo.
Yes.
We don't know if he's evil or if he's good.
Right. But he's appears in the middle of the night.
Should we be afraid for Rebecca?
Yes, very afraid. Art had tied up his boat and was covering the Evan route for the night when the man and Rebecca walked onto his pier. The man who had told Rebecca that he was Santa picked her up and held her in the crook of his left arm. He approached Art silently. Without slowing, he stooped slightly and grabbed a 6-foot oak paddle that was leaning against a 6x6 pylon. He held the paddle wide to his right. Art Radley, whose back was to the man, heard the footfall and turned. In his right hand, he held the folding knife with which he had been trimming rope. He gripped it loosely, point down. Then Art recognized the man.
Greg? Greg Golden? Is that Rebecca Freeman?
Her parents will be relieved. She's been missing since last night.
Greg Golden doesn't say a word, but swings the paddle toward Art Radley.
This isn't a good situation.
Greg has decided, rather than go home, he wants a boat to get out of there, and he's got the little girl.
You get this sense that Art, he knows a little bit about Greg.
Well, he's startled when he hears the noise, and then he turns and sees it's Greg, and there's a little bit of relief, but he's still a little bit wary because Greg has Rebecca. Art realizes that Greg is going to hit him with the paddle, and so he has the knife in his hand, and he starts towards Greg. The paddle connects with a pretty good blow.
Oh!
Ultimately, knocks Art unconscious, but the momentum propels him, and he gets a pretty good lick in himself with his knife. Greg is bleeding profusely with Rebecca in his arms, but he's got access to the boat now. So with his feet, he shuffles Art off the pier, drops him into the boat. Then he puts Rebecca in the boat, gets in the boat, and off they go. A storm is moving in, the water's rough. Greg really doesn't know anything about driving a boat. It capsizes. Art and Greg both go under, and that's the last
that you hear.
Sometime after 11 p.m. Christmas Eve, the Freemans gathered in their kitchen. Mr. Freeman leaned against the doorframe. Fordor sat next to his mother on the long bench at the long, narrow table, which was cut from an old longleaf pine.
No use going to bed.
At 7 minutes until midnight, a sudden wind blew through the door, a whistling gale that knocked a kerosene lamp off the table. The temperature dropped 40 degrees from 70 to 30. Then they heard a voice.
Special delivery, as promised, by midnight, Christmas Eve.
Art Radley stood against the back wall with Rebecca seated in the crook of his right arm, her arms looped around his neck. Mrs. Freeman pushed back in her chair and fell backwards, but she was up off the floor and grabbing Rebecca before Mr. Freeman had moved the first step toward her. Mrs. Freeman pressed Rebecca's head of curly black hair between her cheek and shoulder. She sank to her knees, her shoulders convulsing. Then Art was gone, and no one could say how he left any more than they could say how he got in. He simply vanished. If he had left through the door, which no one thinks is possible, no one saw him. But all the other possibilities were impossible. When Sheriff Collins knocked on the Freeman's kitchen door at first light and lumbered in, the family was still in the kitchen. Mrs. Freeman was pouring up coffee. In his left hand, the sheriff held a pair of child-sized moccasins. He took a deep breath, parted his lips to deliver his bad news. Then he saw Rebecca asleep in Mr. Freeman's lap. Mr. Freeman saw the surprise in the sheriff's face.
Art found her, brought her home about midnight, on his boat. I figured you'd heard.
Art brought her home?
Rebecca's moccasins.
Where'd Art find her?
At his dock,
not possible.
He told us himself.
Estelle, Art's drowned.
Drowned?
About 10 last night, sometime before midnight.
Later, they would say that Christmas Eve 1942 was the shortest and the longest of their lives. Rebecca's only memory of that night was the moment she slipped out of bed to walk to the post office. She has no memory of Art Radley. So every Christmas, Fordor repeats the story for Rebecca. Their house is long gone, but the pier is intact, and that is where they sit, their legs dangling as Fordor recounts the tale.
And now I'm fishing at midnight. My thoughts are swimming upstream. If I could go swim.
So it looks like a happy ending.
Yeah, it's a happy ending, but it's a mysterious happy ending.
With this story with Rebecca, who knows how she appears, and it's as if the ghost, Art, brings her back.
Yes, but it's just a Christmas miracle that doesn't have any real explanation, and so people just attribute it to a miracle.
All right, so let's hear the ending.
45 years later, after Fordor retired from the paper mill, he took over the river route from Art Radley's son, thus earning fame as the only river route letter carrier in the United States. And that is how Fordor came to tell this story to the reporter from Mobile, who wrote the end of the story this way. The west wind sizzled through the tree branches and slapped the water against the riverbank, he tells her. And then Fordor heard the voice, which he took for the wind.
Rebecca.
But the voice persisted, a whisper, distinct, unmistakable, lifting fog-like from the river, whispering to him. And the voice frightened him because he thought the river was telling him he'd never see his sister again and that he was to blame. Last Christmas, though, for the first time, Rebecca wasn't in Magnolia Springs. She was in Denver with her son and his wife for the birth of their first child. But Fordor went to the pier anyway. He dangled his legs off the pier, and just like that night 50 years ago, a west wind blew in. Fordor looked upriver, where he saw what he thought was a glow that he assumed was the moon reflecting off the water. The light advanced downriver, though, and soon took on the form of a boat, Art's boat, lighting silently the final distance to the pier. Fordor remained still, trying not to breathe, trying to blink away what he was seeing. But instead, Art appeared in the boat. Art reached toward Fordor, a package in his hand. From Monkey Ward? No sound came from the apparition. Fordor reached for the package and it was only air. But as he grabbed at nothing, he noticed the four-year-old version of Rebecca sitting in Art's boat, and he heard it again as clearly as he had 50 years ago.
Rebecca.
And now I'm fishing.
I wasn't expecting the very end with the little girl in the boat. So real quick before we go, it's Christmas time, and I guess we need to hug our kids.
And watch the doors.
But it'll all be all right, right, Jay?
Yeah.
Thank you so much. It was terrific.
Thank you for letting me do this.
All right.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to singers and songwriters, Tim Anthony and Frank Thurman on the lute. Thank you to the damsels in distress for the superlative score. Thank you to actors, Kyle Dean, Michael Hiblett, Sloan Greeland, Miles Miller, Dan Shelton, Michael DeAngelis, and Annika Dean as Rebecca. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writer Jay Greeland for providing us with a true Christmas miracle. For Arts and Letters, I'm Jay Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Gladys Tabor. Christmas is a bridge. We need bridges as the river of time flows past.